want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
You've got the very latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for downloading us. I appreciate that. And I'm grateful to Susan Fellows, Scott Bigelow, Paul L. Sesser, and Marion Delgado in honor of Sherry Haskins. They are all voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show. If you'd like to be a copycat and you've got the funds to do it, I don't want your unemployment check. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com, on the right-hand side of the homepage are the links, and our voluntary subscriptions start at $5 a month. I spent the earlier part of this week in Washington, D.C., and I looked far and wide trying to find the debt ceiling, but it was not in evidence. I spent an afternoon marching with 1,000 nurses around the Chamber of Commerce to introduce them to the National Nurses United Main Street contract, which calls for a tax on financial transactions to raise funds for single-payer health care for all. It's audacious, but if anybody can pull it off, it's those nurses.
The court's in session. The court's in session. Now, here come the judge. Here come the judge.
Here come the judge.
And I was on Capitol Hill, and I circled by the Supreme Court building, where Clarence Thomas still holds a lifetime appointment.
Don't nobody budge, 'cause here come the judge. Judge Shorty is presiding today, and he don't take no stuff from nobody, no kind of way.
Now, Clarence Thomas don't take no stuff from nobody, no how, no way. But his wife does, and that is the subject of our discussion today. Kevin Zeese returns to our program, attorney, activist, and among other titles, he is director of itsoureconomy.us. He's also been leading the charge to expose the severe conflict of interest posed by the activities of Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Kevin, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
Well,
to hear from you.
These are very important issues, and while I spent time in the Capitol, the news coverage was devoted to two stories. I think her name is Cindy Anthony. She is on trial in Florida for killing her baby, and then it's Anthony Weiner. So I came down with Cindy Anthony Weiner, and I can't even remember if that's the Anthony girl's first name, because I detest these local crime stories that are spilled out tabloid style on the cable news channels. But since May 15th, when Clarence Thomas filed his updated financial disclosure form as required by law, there's been almost no coverage of the information that was disclosed there, because it occurred simultaneously with the self-inflicted Twitter wounds of Congressman Anthony Weiner. So let's go back to May 15th, and if you could recap for us what Clarence Thomas disclosed in his filings.
Yeah, well, this is a kind of a long saga, but the most recent filing that you mentioned indicated that Thomas invested up to $15,000, they don't give a specific amount, in a Tea Party group that his wife was essentially running. And his wife, the report, the financial disclosure report indicates, received salary and benefits from that group, Liberty Consulting. And And what's interesting, of course, about this is the timing of it all, because she was able to raise more than $500,000 in a few months a year ago, just at the time when Citizens United was being considered. Citizens United was that 5-4 decision that allowed unlimited contributions by corporations and others in elections and independent campaigns. And so she immediately raised a ton of money with that, and it almost looks like a judicial insider trading situation where Jeannie Thomas knew Citizens United was coming, set up a nonprofit to take advantage of it, and raised a ton of money as a result of it. And so this is why I say it's a long saga, is because Citizens United goes back all the way to Justice Thomas's nomination. You recall he had a very, very difficult nomination battle back in 1991.
Well, and in fact, Kevin, I was fortunate enough to be in the Capitol at that time, and I attended two of the confirmation hearing sessions of Justice Thomas and watched as senators like Hal Heflin of Alabama and Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts were so intimidated that this unqualified African-American had been put forward by George H.W. Bush. And I was there before the whole Anita Hill sidebar story surfaced. But the elderly members of the U.S. Senate were clearly flummoxed as they were trying to find a way to deny confirmation to a man who clearly didn't live up to the billing as the most qualified man in America. That's what Bush told us about Clarence Thomas. And so it was a contentious process even before the Anita Hill campaign bubbled up.
That's right. It was a very tough nomination battle, and one of the key turning points in that battle was a group that was little known at the time. This may have been one of its first major activities, and that was Citizens United.
Yep.
And what they did was they put $100,000, which, you know, 20 years ago was even more money than it is today, into a television advertising campaign. And as Time Magazine reported, they probably got $1 million of publicity out of it. And what they did was they attacked people like Hal Heflin, who were questioning Clarence Thomas. And so if you think they were intimidated, you know, just by the color of Thomas's skin, I think they even got more intimidated when they saw that an advertising campaign was going to be run against them if they opposed Thomas's nomination. And so Thomas was helped greatly to get on the bench by Citizens United. And then, you know, 20 years later, in a 5-4 decision, he did not disclose Citizens United helped him get nominated. He did not recuse himself from the case because Citizens United was a complainant and a participant in the a party in the case, and should have recused himself for that reason. And if it had been a 4-4 decision, it would have been a whole different outcome because of the lower court ruling. So that refusal to recuse himself led to Jeannie Thomas then profiting from Citizens United decision. And what we're calling for, and we're doing this through Protect Our Elections, which is a velvetrevolution.us project where I'm the attorney and spokesperson, what we're doing is we're calling for an investigation by the Department of Justice to look into this, to see what was going on and what happened to the money that was raised, and how much money did Jeannie Thomas benefit as a result of this this project that seemed to benefit from the Citizens United decision. So we think Thomas should be investigated. I suspect if he is investigated, we'll find some serious problems there, and I wouldn't be surprised if he resigned before any investigation was completed.
And Kevin Zeese, you're the lawyer here, so educate me a little bit about recusal, because as I understand it, this is a very wobbly issue that is difficult to enforce. And what's most interesting to me was it's just a couple of years ago that Clarence Thomas was on the court and participated in a ruling that upbraided a Supreme Court justice in the state of West Virginia.
That's right.
For failing to recuse himself from a case where he clearly was conflicted. There was campaign money that came from the mining interests, and he was ruling in favor of mining interests. And so the U.S. Supreme Court set some fairly still loose standards for recusal by justices on state Supreme Courts. But there is no higher body than the U.S. Supreme Court, and we've seen that Antonin Scalia went duck hunting with Cheney, that Scalia and Thomas have been to the Koch brothers' political parties in Palm Springs and elsewhere, And they really set their own standards on recusal. Is there any way to enforce them beyond simply trying to embarrass people who appear to be impossible to embarrass?
I think that's a good summary. That decision, the West Virginia case, involved Massey Energy. Don Blankenship of Massey Energy and the company gave a lot of money to get a Supreme Court of the state put on the bench in an election. And then that Supreme Court justice was the deciding vote in a case favoring Massey Energy. The Supreme Court reversed it and sent it back because of that conflict of interest, saying the justice should recuse himself. The problem with the Supreme Court is that there is no recusal process. It's basically left to the whim of the justice, him or herself. Now, there are justices who have recused themselves on numerous cases because of conflicts. You know, when they heard the case in a lower court, where they argued the case as Solicitor General, where they worked for the corporation involved. I mean, all sorts of different reasons for recusal. But it's something that's up to individual justice, and there's no review process. What people have suggested some solutions to that. One would be a rotating group of three justices who review recusal motions by litigants. So if a lawyer sees a potential conflict, they file a request for recusal, and then a panel of three justices, you know, that would rotate randomly would make the decision, and not the justice him or herself. The problem in Thomas's case, it made it even worse, and this is really what is the criminal or civil penalty problem, is for 20 years Justice Thomas did not disclose his wife's income sources. There's a short financial disclosure form that requires the third question, in fact, asks what the income of your family members are, and his wife was making hundreds of thousands of dollars from conservative think tanks, and it resulted in them not knowing the conflict of interest, and because of that lack of knowledge about the conflict of interest, they couldn't request recusal. And so that was a problem. You didn't even know the conflicts because he didn't disclose. And the form itself says, right above his signature, right below his signature, it says that failure to disclose in this form could result in civil and criminal penalties. And there have been cases where Justice Thomas has sat on the bench of people who were subjected to incarceration for filling these kinds of forms out wrong. But Thomas filled them out wrong for 20 years. And so far, there's been no sanction to him at all for that.
So then it's kind of a dead end to try to pursue any cause of action related to recusal. Certainly reforms are needed there, but we're in a situation where, like Wall Street, the Supreme Court is left to regulate itself. And that's distressing, but it does appear there is a cause of action related to his false filing.
Exactly.
Of these disclosure forms. So
that's right.
I understand that you have moved to get bar discipline for Justice Thomas for these failings.
That's right. We filed with Missouri on that. We've also filed with the Department of Justice and the FBI seeking an investigation and seeking a prosecution. I mean, I think it's necessary for that to go forward. You shouldn't have the highest court in the land, a justice on the highest court in the land, wantonly disobeying the law and not being sanctioned for it. I mean, this is a top justice and top lawyer in the country. Certainly he can read a short form and answer a very simple question about his wife's income. And it can't be anything but an intentional decision on his part not to disclose that information to the public and also to litigants who have cases before him.
And does the consistency that he failed to do this for 20 years, that tends to support the interpretation here that it was willful because some sort of a lapse or inattentiveness, it would be hard to replicate that 20 years running. And reading the same language in bold type that says any individual who knowingly and willfully falsifies or fails to file this report may be subject to civil and criminal sanctions. I mean, he is, after all, a lawyer.
A lawyer and a top justice on the Supreme Court of the United States. Yeah, so I think it seems on its face, as they say, there's prima facie evidence that he certainly violated the law and did so intentionally, and that should be investigated and, if necessary, prosecuted.
Now, Kevin Zeis, you have assembled a timeline here, and timelines can be really helpful in looking back and analyzing the actions of people and speculating about their motivations. So if we start in September of 2009, when the Citizens United oral arguments were held at the Supreme Court, then it was less than 2 months later that Virginia Thomas launched Liberty Central, a 501c4. And under the IRS rules, a C4 is a nonprofit organization that is permitted to engage in advocacy. And that permits them to argue in favor of certain philosophies or policies. And Liberty Central was set up as a C4. And in 2009 alone, they raised about $500,000, $550,000. It was just 2 months later that the Citizens United decision came down. And 2 months after that, we're operating here in about two-month intervals so far, Liberty Central said they would accept donations from various sources, including corporations, as allowed under campaign finance rules recently loosened by the Supreme Court. Now, this ties directly under community property laws, the self-interest of Virginia Thomas with the self-interest and the potential conflict of interest of one Clarence Thomas, does it not?
That's exactly why we put the time limit up, to give people a kind of a vision of how this developed, that she raised a lot of money before Citizens United and then immediately jumped on Citizens United as an opportunity to expand further. It's worth noting that these 501c4 organizations were what the Republicans used in the midterm elections to hide anonymous donations in elections. Federal election law requires disclosure of identities of sources of income, and you set up an election organization, a 527, a political action committee, in order to take donations. But Karl Rove and others found that they weren't raising as much money as they hoped, and so they set up 501c4 organizations. And the key difference there is, well, two. One is the C4 is not required to disclose the identity of the donors.
Right.
That way they can evade the election law. But the other key distinction is C4 is not really supposed to be election organizations. They're really supposed to be primarily a lobbying and advocacy organization. They could do some electioneering, but should not be their major purpose. Karl Rove set up American Crossroads, GPS, as totally an election organization, so he misused the tax law to avoid the reporting requirements of the election laws. And that is what Jenny Thomas also set up, was a 501c4, and then she also went into electioneering mode as well as soon as Citizens United was announced.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the shuffle here? And I want listeners to listen carefully, because Liberty Central was the C4 organization we just referred to. And then in November of 2010, Virginia Thomas left Liberty Central, and 2 days later she incorporated Liberty Consulting in the state of Virginia, where she and the associate justice live. And what is Liberty Consulting, and how is it different from Liberty Central, from what you've been able to research?
Well, that's a good question. We actually, Velvet Revolution, which is velvetrevolution.us, actually went out to look at the suite of Liberty Central. What we found was a P.O. box. And so it was kind of a non-existent entity as far as a mailing address goes. Then what happened was Liberty, Jenny Thomas found her name on a memorandum from Liberty Central saying that the health care law was unconstitutional. And that was right after that is when she left Liberty Central, I guess you'd say, in the scandal, because, of course, her husband will be ruling on that health care law in not too distant future. And so that raised some interesting ethical issues for Thomas, you know, whether he should actually be sitting on the bench when that case is heard. Then she goes, and so that had raised, you know, $550,000 in the latter part of the year before that. We don't know how much money it raised in the year after that, and we don't know what that money was spent for. They have not yet filed their taxes. They've asked for delay till August, so we'll see maybe we'll see more information when that comes out. Liberty Consulting, we don't know anything much about as far as much money it's raised or what it does. We just know that Jenny Thomas works for it and has the same name, Liberty, and that's all we know about it. So we'll have to see what this all evolves into, but it's an unfolding story and quite an interesting one.
And what are some of the other consulting gigs that Jenny Thomas has had? Didn't she generate income from the Heritage Foundation for a number of years?
That was a major source of income for Thomas, and she got hundreds of thousands of dollars over that 20 years of non-disclosure from the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation is this extreme right-wing think tank in Washington, D.C., that, you know, all the conservative Republicans rely on to kind of push the corporate agenda. And so she was part of that. And, of course, a group like Heritage Foundation has lots of issues that go before the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's why if litigants knew she was getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Heritage Foundation, they would have reason to ask for Thomas to recuse himself, because issues that his family is profiting from are now before the Supreme Court, and he should not be deciding things that affect his wife's income.
And, again, this recusal issue becomes problematic because it is really at the discretion of the justice.
Right.
Has there been any interest in on the part of our Justice Department, under Attorney General Eric Holder, to pursue either the failure to report the wife's income or these thornier issues of failure to recuse?
Well, we're still pushing on that, and people should go to velvetrevolution.us and sign up and get involved so we can keep pushing on it. We have not gotten a strong response other than kind of pro forma responses from DOJ and the FBI that they'll, you know, refer this to the appropriate person and investigate if necessary or if appropriate. So, you know, we need to keep pushing, and I think that's really the avenue to go. I don't think Congress will do what it should do, which is start to go into an impeachment proceeding. I think the Republican Congress is unlikely to do that to a Republican Supreme Court justice, and that would be where impeachment would start. So really the power rests with the FBI and the Department of Justice, and that's where the pressure needs to be put.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see as potential sanctions here? They would probably pursue a civil route as opposed to criminal. Not that I don't think what Mr. Thomas has done here might not rise to the level of criminality, but just because of the cozy nature of relationships between the Justice Department and the Supreme Court, would you think it's more likely that they'd try to get him to approach it as a civil case, pay some fines, and move on?
Well, you know, if we had this was a reverse situation, and we had a Republican Attorney General and Democrat in a closely divided court, Democrat justice in a closely divided court who was caught in this kind of a scandal, I think we have a whole different approach. They're much more hardball, much more willing to use their power to get what they want, and they would know that removing another Democrat on the court would help their abortion agenda or, you know, those kinds of issues, just as, you know, removing a Republican might help some of the Democrats' agenda. But the Democrats kind of tend to play softball. So your guesses might be right, but there certainly are people who are in jail for filing disclosure reforms falsely. And I don't know of any case where someone's done it for 20 years in a row, and certainly not any case where it was someone who was a top lawyer in the country and a member of the Supreme Court who certainly should be able to read a simple form and fill it out quite correctly.
Well, and I'm just wondering if somebody has scoured the rulings that have been written by Clarence Thomas, the decisions and opinions. I'll bet he's got some real tough language for people who failed to observe the law for 20 years in a row. I just can imagine that he's capable of that kind of righteous indignation.
Well, I think that's one interesting area, but I think the more interesting area of review I'd love to see somebody do. We look at the cases that he's ruled, and especially close 5-4 cases, that were issues that the Heritage Foundation was working on, that his wife was profiting from. I think that'd be a really interesting list of where Thomas ruled in the majority in cases where his wife's employer benefited. That'd be the really interesting one.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, I want to move on to a couple of other issues. Is there anything that you'd like to mention about the Thomas situation that we didn't cover?
Well, yeah, we started to get some traction on Thomas in the Congress, and unfortunately the traction was coming from Anthony Weiner. He was actually starting to complain about that, and then unfortunately Weiner's Weiner got in the way, and he kind of got off track. And
Now he just mistweeted.
He did mistweet, that's for sure. He really mistweeted. There are some other congressional allies, but
let's pause for a moment here and put the dick jokes aside, because you know Weiner has revealed himself to be a dick, and I'll just stipulate that. But he didn't break any laws. And he didn't, you know, violate any professional code of ethics. This is a personal failure on his part. And I think it's really important to draw this distinction because we have clear violations by Clarence Thomas here that go unaddressed. While there's a media frenzy because, you know, private parts and sexuality is involved to, you know, really make hay out of what Congressman Wiener did. But, you know, when
That's just because the royal wedding's over.
Oh, okay.
We have to have something to talk about other than, you know, the realities of the world.
Right. Well, I guess
you make a good point, though. The distinction between what Thomas did and what Wiener did, one is a question of criminality for sure, and I think that's certainly a civil violation, you know, a legal violation. So you make a good point that Wiener didn't break any laws. I saw a poll today that showed 3/4 of his people in his district think he should stay on. They don't think he should resign over it because it's not he didn't do anything illegal. He showed bad judgment for sure, and probably needs some psychological help, but. It's a totally different ballgame than Justice Thomas, who actually seems to have broken the law.
Yeah. So I want to turn to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where there was a very close election recently for a 10-year term. And our mutual friend and colleague Brad Friedman at bradblog.com has done, again, the best job in the country of covering the election issues and the partial recount, which occurred, and the many very significant anomalies that surfaced, the Waukesha missing 14,000 votes, and when they went to recount and audit, ballot bags that had been sealed when they left a precinct were gaping open and could have been messed with. There were just many issues, and the corporate media in this country, while it initially covered this race, gave up and moved on. And there are many essential issues here. Let me try to enumerate them. First and foremost, that we can't trust the election process, and Wisconsin is about to go through recall elections that could recast the majority in the state Senate and prevent further Republican mischief by Scott Walker and the majorities that he has under the Fitzgerald brothers. Not only that, we have the so-called budget repair bill, which has been overturned by a lower court judge because of failure to observe the open meeting laws of Wisconsin in ramming it through. And that case is working its way to the state Supreme Court, where David Prosser is going to be able to review it should he not recuse himself, which he should do, but probably will not. And so we have once again many of the issues that we confront of money in politics, elections that we can't trust, and people who get elected who don't deserve the public trust. And so Wisconsin is just another microcosm of these viruses that we fight every day, Kevin.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the recount there was a real shame. I think people really were hopeful when they heard there was going to be a statewide recount that the surprise 7,000 plus votes that came out for Prosser out of a county that a township that was known for sloppy election procedures and that was allies of Prosser's, that we're going to get a real recount. But when the recount started to go, it was a shambles. I mean, the pictures you mentioned, the open pouches of ballots. If you see the photos of those pouches that had ballots in them that were supposed to be sealed, it's quite evident that it would be very easy to reach into those pouches, take the ballots out, replace them, change them, whatever you want to do to them, and put them back. Or you could add new ballots. You could go to the absentee, you know, who didn't vote file and add a bunch of voters to the ballots. I mean, so there's so many. It's a real shame because it shows how we don't take democracy seriously in this country, that an important race like that, that determines really the balance of power in the Supreme Court, which would have been the only check and balance against the legislature and governor. And we didn't take the vote wasn't taken seriously. The count wasn't taken seriously. It was a sloppy count. And I'm just disappointed that Kloppenburg didn't keep pursuing it. She should have. I don't know why she backed down, but that's often the common reaction of politicians, that they don't keep pushing it to the end and really seek a real Democratic vote. But this is at least they had ballots there. But you'd think with ballots they would actually count the ballots correctly and deal with these chain of custody problems. I mean, I'm not sure what to do to clean it up, but it certainly should be something that was exposed and should have gotten major media attention about the frailty of our democracy and how you really can't trust the votes in this country anymore.
Well, and it also just speaks to the sweep of corporate interests. And, this is a very critical time. It's not just that we have Supreme Courts that are now routinely packed with pro-corporate judges who have been placed there with huge amounts of campaign cash from the very corporations that expect to own them on those courts.
Right.
But we have the failure, really, of Democrats to properly wage the contest last year in the midterm elections. We now have Republican governors in over 30 state capitals with compliant Republican legislatures. And it has allowed this group, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Committee, to circulate boilerplate legislation to gut the rights of unions to organize and, in the worst case in Michigan, essentially allow economic martial law, where the governor gets to appoint a receiver who takes control of a municipality and the elected officials don't count, contracts don't count. It's just dictatorial powers. And it's really scary because all of this is promoting a class war that was initiated by the wealthiest interests in our country. And as soon as Democrats fight back, we are accused, or working people, we're accused of starting a class war. And I believe that while we're arguing over who started it, the oligarchs are winning it.
No question. I think we have a deep culture of corruption in our government. You see it with the crony capitalism that gives away literally hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer dollars to the wealthiest in the country through corporate welfare and giveaways and loan guarantees. I mean, the whole nuclear industry wouldn't exist if it was not for loan guarantees and the taxpayer, funding their insurance. I mean, on issue after issue, you see this. And sadly, it's both political parties are deep into corporate interests. President Obama got $20 million when he ran for office from the health insurance industry. Then he kept single-payer health care out of the debate and, put in place a bill that will give hundreds of millions of dollars a year to the insurance industry and tax subsidies. So it was a good investment on their part, and we'll be interested to see what they do for Obama's billion-dollar campaign in 2012. And so we have a culture of corruption in this country, and we see a dysfunctional government. I think you're seeing more and more around the country, Americans are in revolt about this. You see big ones in places like Madison when they try to take away collective bargaining, the unions come out and fill the streets. But even putting aside those kinds of demonstrations, there are protests all over the country every week on issues about schools being closed, about Latino classes being closed, about tuition increases, about the wealth divide, about banks not paying taxes, about torturing Bradley Manning, about the ongoing wars. And, there was a report that came out a week ago, said almost 3,000 people have been arrested in protesting since Obama came to office. It's going up rapidly. People are frustrated with the government. They see it doesn't work any longer, and they want to find some other way to have an influence on the direction the country's going, because they know that elections just don't work anymore. You have two parties that are dominated by corporate interests, that are funded by corporate funders. The Republicans are very clearly a pro-business party with a conservative political base. The Democrats are a corporately funded party with a left-of-center base. But the Democrats don't listen to their voters because they know the money can go to either Republicans or Democrats, but the voters have nowhere to go in our system because our system prevents them from having a third choice or a fourth choice. They set up the system so only two corporate parties are allowed, only two corporate candidates are allowed, and we get manipulated into voting for one or the other. Neither one of them represents our interests. And so the Democrats keep moving more and more to the business side because they want that business money, and they know their voters have nowhere to go. So we're essentially, the American people are screwed by our democracy, which has become a mirage democracy and not a real one any longer.
So, Kevin, you and like-minded individuals are organizing a rally in Washington on October 6th of this year. And I want people to go to the website, October2011.org. Tell us what the focus is.
Yeah, it's much more than a rally, and it'll go longer than October 6th. It begins on October 6th, and this is essentially an effort to bring Tahrir Square to Washington, D.C.'s Freedom Plaza. October2011.org, you can sign up there and get involved and come to participate in this. But it's going to be an act of civil resistance, not just focused on the government, Congress and White House, but even more so focused on people behind the government, the K Street lobby firms, the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, the military-industrial complex lobby firms. And we're advocating for an end to corporatism, an end to corporate power in our government. And we see this as modeled after the ongoing revolution in Spain that's been going on for the last month that doesn't get much reporting in the United States and Greece as well as, of course, building on Egypt and Tunisia and what's going on in the Arab Spring. But it's time for Americans to wake up and get active. We need to take some power in this country. The only way we're going to shift the power from the corporations and the economic elite who control the government is for the American people to get unified and organized and mobilized. And that's what October2011.org is about. And so I hope people will check it out. We have some great videos on there describing it in more detail. We have some great articles describing it. You can see when you get on there, you'll see a cross-section of people. People from the Vets for Peace who oppose the wars, people from Physicians for National Health Program who want to see single-payer health care plan, people from economic justice groups and a whole range of issues we see unite. Because what's happening on October 6th is that's the 10th anniversary of the Afghanistan war, and October 1st, it's the beginning of the new federal fiscal year, which is a new federal budget that will be austerity for everything except for the military, intelligence gathering, and homeland security. Environmental protection, social safety nets, workers' rights, consumer rights, enforcement against all sorts of violations of business, all that's going to get cut. So we have an austerity budget for everything except for the security state. And so this is an opportunity to link all these issues together to see how the corporatism that dominates our country is undermining all of us. And so please check out October2011.org, sign up and get involved. And when you do, spread the word, because what's going to make this happen is people showing up and participating. We can take the power, shift the power to the people if we demand it. We've got to demand it. It's not going to happen by staying home.
Well, and Kevin, by building this on the 10th anniversary of our invasion of Afghanistan, this again amplifies the message that you gave us a couple of minutes ago, which is the electorate is very clearly opposed to staying in Afghanistan. It's unambiguous. 60 to 70%, except in the post-Osama bounce period. 60 to 70% of Americans polled, including many Republicans, say that there is no mission in Afghanistan, there's no purpose for American troops there, and we should get out. But we see the president toying with his rhetorical promise from December 1st of 2009 at West Point that he's going to pull some troops out of Afghanistan starting next month. I mean, 3 weeks from now. And they still have not identified the number. And while the American public clearly wants us to bring all of our troops out of Afghanistan, the leadership and the Obama administration is playing games with exactly how many will be drawn down. And they are also resisting congressional resolutions or even outright bills to call for a scheduled withdrawal from Afghanistan. And so this disconnect between what the public wants in this alleged democratic country of ours and what the elected officials deliver, it's a widening gap.
Exactly. And that's why I talk about shifting the power of the people away from the economic elites who control the government, who profit from war. The war is just one example of how the public wants one thing and the government does another. Single-payer health care, you can look at polls for the last 5 years that show that the public, by 60% margins, supports single-payer health care. The public wants to see the banks broken up. The banks were not broken up. The public wants to see derivatives regulated. They're not regulated. Issue after issue, they want to see a clean energy economy. Again, it's not done. Pick an issue. The public is in one place. The government economic elites are another place. And if we want to get this government representing us as it's supposed to, we've got to demand it. We have to demand it. It doesn't come to us without us making a demand. And so that's why October2011.org was set up, and we're getting a great response, by the way. It's very. You look at that website, you'll see all sorts of prominent people who already signed on, a wide range of organization. You know, we're going to have tens of thousands of people at this event, so people should feel they want to be part of history. This is the place to come. If you want to be part of history of really putting this country on track, this is the place to be, October 6th and beyond. Freedom Plaza, Washington, D.C. You can sign up and get involved at October 2011.org.
And, Kevin, there are a couple of other exciting efforts underway. At the beginning of this podcast, I referenced that I was in Washington earlier this week with the National Nurses United.
Yeah.
And they have a very aggressive campaign called the Main Street Contract. And they are basically trying to, they're going to confront elected officials of both parties and ask them to sign a pledge, either to support Wall Street out in the open or to support the people and the so-called Main Street interests in this country. And it calls for a tax, a transaction tax on stock transfers and other Wall Street transactions to generate as much as $350 billion a year in new revenue to the government, calls for single-payer health care, and there are a number of other valid issues that they're bringing forward as well.
Well, that tax on the stock and bond and derivatives, I think, is a critical opportunity to begin to shift the power again. Rather than taxing work, we should be taxing wealth. And right now, the wealth is heavily concentrated in the top 0.5%, top 1%. In fact, the top 1% has wealth equal to the bottom 95%. That's where the money is. And if you want to talk about balancing the budget and funding social programs, funding infrastructure, shifting to a clean energy economy, we have to confront two critical things. One is the wealth divide. And you deal with the wealth divide not only by taxing income, but taxing wealth. Not only taxing income of people who make millions of dollars a year, but also taxing wealth, the people who just sit on their money and pay no tax or a very low tax of a 15% capital gains tax when they cash in their money. So tax wealth and face up to the military-industrial complex. Right now, the security budget, which is the military, intelligence, and homeland security, is 65% of federal discretionary spending. If you don't face up to dealing with that 65% of discretionary spending, it means that everything else is going to suffer. And so we have a bloated military. We see the TSA every day. We hear horror stories. I saw one yesterday about a retarded guy who he was in his 20s, but the mind of a two-year-old, and how he was abused by TSA. The day before that, I saw some woman who was groped by TSA agents and went screaming about it. I mean, that's who we're giving more money to. Rather than getting that under control and making it reasonable, we keep getting more extreme that way. So we need to, people need to say what they want. They need to get educated, organized, and mobilized to demand what they want. And that's what October 2011 is about. And I really appreciate National Nurses United, who is one of the stronger unions out there, pushing this agenda of taxing wealth more and work less.
And, Kevin, there's one other spot of activism that you tipped me off to. There's a conference coming up at Kent State in Ohio later in the summer, and it's an emergency labor conference. Tell us what you know about that.
Well, it's Labor Fight Back, and what you're seeing now in labor, I think, is really interesting. A lot of labor is, of course, very upset about the direction that some of these governors around the country are going, taking away collective bargaining rights, but they're also very upset with the way Democrats have not come through on their promises to labor, despite the fact that without labor support, the Democrats could not win. I mean, every election cycle, labor pours literally hundreds of millions of dollars and many, many hours of people's so-called volunteer time into these campaigns, knocking on doors, making telephone calls, stuffing envelopes. And when they get elected, they get ignored. Trumka has been, the head of the AFL-CIO, has been really shouting loudly at the Democrats that he's not going to support them this next time around. And I really hope that's true, because I think the Democrats need to learn a lesson, either become extinct or be replaced by a truly workers' party.
And let me just jump in, because Rich Trumka gave a speech to the assembled nurses in
right.
Washington.
That's right.
And one of his comments, which I doubt was in the prepared text, was he looked at the crowd and he talked about the way labor has funded the electoral aims of the Democrats year after year. And he looked at us and he said, I've had a snootful of this shit.
That's right. That's right. That got some attention. And I think the Democrats are hearing that as well. I hope that they take him seriously and start to change their behavior. But my sense is the Democrats are not reformable and that we're going to have to replace them. That's my guess. I think the money's just too deep in that party. And it's going to take labor waking up and seeing it and saying, enough of this, I've had a snootful, and walking away from it. But people need to realize what's going on and get organized and get mobilized. And that's what it's going to take. You can't sit back and just, do Facebook. You've got to get out and do something more than that. And that means getting out and getting active. So I hope people will do that. I'll mention once again October2011.org. I think that's the most important project of many I'm working on. So I hope people will come to Washington and be part of that.
Well, Kevin, you set a great example. I don't know when you rest, but you're very active on many fronts, and I really appreciate the work you do.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate doing your show because you're always so on top of things, and I appreciate that a great deal.
You bet. Kevin Zeese, thanks for joining me today.
All right, thank you.
And I got to burn through the backlog of Wilder's commentaries that have been piling up in my email inbox. Here's one more from Will about the GOP death wish. Take it away, Will Durst.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few words about the Republican plan to reform Medicare, which is a lot like saying the tornado plan to reform trailer courts. Of course, I'm talking about Paul Ryan's budget, in which he uses a chainsaw to perform major surgery on Medicare without benefit of an anesthetic. His plan is to replace unlimited blanket care for elders with fixed-value vouchers. Coupons. He's going to hand out health care coupons. Why? Well, because it would save lots of money that he then plans to give to rich people through increased tax cuts. And besides, old people like coupons. We might even be able to convince Groupon to move into the health care field. Colonoscopies, normally $5,000, today only $1,200. But we need to pre-sell $2,500 by 4 p.m. Then we could phase in early bird organ transplants and discounted cardiac defibrillators at the Everything for a Dollar store. Newt Gingrich called the plan right-wing social engineering before being taken to the woodshed, after which he recanted and said any ad that Democrats air using his quote is a lie, which is redundant because every ad using one of his quotes is a lie. Donald Trump called it the Republican death wish, and when Trump is the guy in your party willing to speak truth to power, baby, you get problems. What has the GOP running scared is a recent special election, where the Democrats used the Medicare issue to win a New York congressional seat that had been in Republican hands since Ichabod Crane ran on the Whig ticket. Admittedly, it's a long way to the 2012 elections, especially when you consider American voters have the attention span of high-speed lint, but you might want to get used to seeing ads with old people being attacked by tax-cut zombies. That's the bad news. The good news is only 17 months until the election. Forgive me while I slip into the fetal position to wait it out. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
And thanks for checking out today's podcast. Share it with a friend. You know how to do it. Facebook, the internet. Go ahead, Twitter, but not to Anthony Weiner, okay?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.